Voices Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
Richard Falk is UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, also Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University, and the author of more than 50 books on war, human rights, and international law, including Israel-Palestine on Record, How the New York Times Misreports Conflict in the Middle East. Just days after calling the Israeli blockade of Gaza a crime against humanity, Richard Falk was detained and then expelled from Israel. Richard Falk is with us now, recently returned from delivering a statement to the special session of the Human Rights Council on the situation in the Gaza Strip. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, I want you to help us understand a lot more in detail, or perhaps debunk some of the mythology that has been spewed really by American media continuously. And maybe the first place to begin with that is the issue of the breaches by Hamas, presumably, of the ceasefire as a rationalization for this tremendous, frightening firepower against the people of Gaza.
Yes, I think that's a really important issue that has been presented to the American public in a most misleading way, because the facts are that Hamas had substantially adhered to the ceasefire since it had gone into effect in June of 2008 and continued to adhere to it despite the fact that Israel hadn't fulfilled its side of the ceasefire bargain, which was to ease the blockade that was preventing food, medicine, and fuel from reaching Gazan civilian society. Beyond that, the provocation that produced the Hamas rocket fire of any consequence occurred in retaliation for Israel's incursion into Gaza on November 4th, which killed several Palestinians and was a military operation that definitely was a major breach of the ceasefire. That incident has barely been touched upon in American mainstream media and gives the impression then that Israel's military operation starting on December 27th was a retaliatory operation. We know that Israel had been planning this military campaign for several months and that the timing of it was probably mainly connected with the combination of American political situation of being in the last days of the Bush presidency and prior to the Obama presidency and the upcoming Israeli February elections for prime minister. So it had very little to do with anything that one could attribute to Hamas, and quite a bit to do with Israel's undisclosed objectives in launching this huge military campaign.
Well, let's just probe even a little deeper, and information that has been absorbed by the bulk of the American public is that what is a poor country to do, specifically the southern part of Israel, as Qassam rockets are launched into and jeopardize the population in that territory. So what is the response, and how are we to understand that as well?
I have, in my role as Special Rapporteur on the Palestinian territories, consistently condemned the firing of rockets from Gaza as being unlawful and immoral and politically very imprudent on the part of Hamas. But it should be put in some kind of perspective. Prior to the December 27th attacks, as far as the record available shows, no Israeli death had resulted from those rockets in approximately a year, and certainly none from the time the ceasefire went into effect. If Israel was really genuinely concerned about protecting its society, it has a very simple way of proceeding, and that is to support the ceasefire and to lift the blockade. Hamas has made it repeatedly clear that it is prepared and eager to extend the ceasefire, even for a period as long as 10 years. And there's one report in The Economist that suggests that Hamas would be receptive to a 20-year ceasefire. And so one has to wonder, why has Israel not explored these options? And it's not good enough to say that Hamas is a terrorist organization, which is a label that precludes diplomacy and would be just as inappropriate to use with reference to Israel by calling it a terrorist state. I was reminded of a discussion that John Major, the former British Prime Minister, had about his approach to finding peace in Northern Ireland. And he said that as long as he regarded the IRA as a terrorist organization, he made no progress whatsoever. But as soon as he began to think about what were their grievances and how to deal with them as a political actor, it began to be possible to work toward a solution and to establish a genuine peace process. And that's really what happened there, but has never happened in relation to Gaza since Hamas was elected in a democratic election back in January of 2006.
Now you're contradicting President Bush, who referred to that process as one of a coup d'etat.
Yes, well, not the first time I've contradicted President Bush, I must confess, but I think Bush was referring not to the elections themselves, but to the subsequent fight with Fatah, the political arm of the Palestinian Authority, that occurred somewhat later in 2007 and produced this Hamas governmental control over the activities in Gaza.
One of the things that is so extraordinary, there was an article that appeared where there was a very distinct proposal and desire for the Israeli government to pursue using bombardment against what it was proclaiming as a nuclear development site in Iran, and had this discourse with the Bush administration. And interestingly enough, the Bush administration rejected the proposal. The reason I'm bringing that up is just the relationship and the enabling of the Bush administration, of this government, of this country, to allow for and to perhaps in many instances encourage the activity of Israel against the Palestinian groupings. And I was wondering how you look at that relationship and perhaps look at it within the context of international law.
Well, that's an interesting, complicated, elusive set of issues that I think it is very important, but not entirely clear to what extent the United States calls the tune, so to speak, with respect to Israeli policy, and to what extent it follows what Israel does in a more or less passive, supportive capacity. I think this dramatic story about the United States turning down Israel's requests is something of an exception to the rule of a strategic relationship in which the United States has tended to be overwhelmingly supportive of Israel's strategic undertaking. And I think as far as the Palestinians are concerned, the U.S. has, during the Bush administration and generally prior to that as well, deferred to Israel's approach, however inconsistent it is with international law and to some degree with our own law. For instance, the use of American-supplied weaponry is by U.S. law not allowed to be used except in a defensive mode. And it's very hard to validate what is happening in Gaza as defensive unless one neglects the real sequence of developments and the background of the illegal blockade and the way in which Israel provoked this breakdown of the ceasefire by engaging in cross-border military incursions that seemed designed to be provocative.
I had just briefly mentioned law, and I'm interested in whether or not, in your evaluation, the activity of Israel, which is so devastating to the civilian population, or the population in general of Gaza, this 1.5 million people huddled, crammed into this small swath of land. What are the legal ramifications or implications under international humanitarian law?
Well, Mimi, that's a very important, increasingly discussed dimension of this Israeli military operation. Certainly the tactics that have been relied upon by Israel and the whole use of modern weaponry against an essentially defenseless society that had already been weakened by the 18 months of blockade certainly suggests that there's a basis for alleging violations of the law of war, of international humanitarian law, and the commission of war crimes associated with crimes against humanity and other breaches of international criminal law. Those allegations need to be confirmed by some kind of investigative process, and the UN does have the authority to establish such procedures as it did for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda after the genocide took place there in 1994. Whether the political will exists to do that in this setting is somewhat doubtful, in my view, and unfortunate, because it conveys the impression that international law is only available to discipline and regulate the weak, and so far as those that are powerful are concerned, they enjoy exemption or impunity when it comes to accountability for their violations of international law.
Since I had mentioned the story about the potential for bombing, which many of us had been concerned about, Iran, the more recent article was also that there was a demand from the Israeli government directly to President Bush during a speech in which he was actually asked to leave the podium, presumably, to take the phone call. And the demand was that Condoleezza Rice emphatically vote against the proposal for a ceasefire that was ensuing and being discussed within the United Nations. And indeed, she actually did not vote against it, but she abstained. And I thought that was, again, if it is true, the State Department says it wasn't, but one could well believe it. Quite a remarkable relationship and demand, and seems to be part of certainly our special relationship with Israel that has become virtually exclusive.
Yes, it is. I think it is very disturbing, and because it is the kind of relationship that should be investigated in a democratic society, an additional reason to be troubled by it is that Congress is so unconditionally one-sided in its endorsement of anything Israel does that one doesn't have the benefit of checks and balances when it comes to this strategic relationship between the United States and Israel. And in that sense, it's a deep challenge to the basic constitutional conception of the separate branches of government and the importance of having Congress monitor precisely this kind of unhealthy sort of strategic intimacy that has grown up between Israel and the United States. And if this incident is somewhat accurate, it doesn't have to be literally accurate, if it is indicative of that kind of relationship, it suggests a very unhealthy kind of diplomatic subordination that the United States seems to feel obliged to practice in its relationship with Israel, at least during the Bush presidency.
As I indicated to begin with, you had recently returned from a special session of the Human Rights Council on the situation in Gaza, and I'm interested in some of the recommendations that became the attention or focus of the special session as made by yourself.
Well, I guess that the most important recommendations were three that I would mention. One was that the General Assembly seek an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice on the status under international law of what Israel has done in Gaza since the December 27th attacks. I think that would provide an authoritative documentation of just how persuasive is the Israeli contention that they were retaliating against Hamas rockets. And also it would provide the basis for evaluating the tactics being relied upon by Israel during this military operation. A second major recommendation was actually directed toward me and several other special rapporteurs to prepare a special report on the impact of this military operation on the human rights and well-being of the population of Gaza. And the third recommendation was to ask Israel to cooperate with the United Nations in discharging its official functions to monitor human rights in the occupied territories, and in effect that seeks to have Israel reverse the kind of approach it used in relation to me when it excluded me from entering the territory of Israel to gain access to the West Bank and Gaza.
I did want to mention that certainly you had been detained for some hours and denied entry because of what Israel called your highly politicized views. Is there any indication that Israel will be more receptive to the professional role that you perform now in relationship to what was one of your suggestions and hopes, certainly in terms of your own role?
Well, I would have to be more optimistic than I am to anticipate any change in the Israeli approach on these issues. I think it is important to see whether there is some greater willingness on the part of the Israeli government to cooperate with the UN, but I don't think it's very likely. They do have a legal obligation to cooperate as a member of the organization with its official function, but I think they have been all along rather protective of the way in which the occupation, especially in Gaza, has been handled, and they've kept foreign journalists out as well as people like myself, and they've kept Palestinians who have credibility as journalists or human rights specialists or members of non-governmental organizations, they've kept them from leaving Gaza. And so it is a concerted policy, I think, of what I call the politics of opaqueness, trying to conceal the actualities of the occupation from scrutiny by the outside world.
I can't help but think, as I watch some of the film footage that gets through, which is generally from a distance and still resembles the video games, but we do know now that white phosphorus gas and shells is being used in missiles that really do burn the flesh and can burn it down to the bone. We certainly know that there is metal explosives, so-called dimes, that can cut victims to ribbons. There is depleted uranium that will wreak havoc with survivors. Do these things constitute, do you have any expectation that the General Assembly would look at these as war crimes against the Israeli government towards the people of Gaza?
As far as I can tell, the General Assembly, or many members of the General Assembly, certainly view these weapons and tactics as war crimes. Whether there exists the political climate to establish some kind of inquiry process that tries to determine the legal status of such weapons in a more professional way, I'm not sure.
And in the remaining moment that we have, what would be some of your final comments relevant to this ghastly situation in Gaza?
Well, I think, Mimi, it's a horrible ongoing humanitarian catastrophe that is unfolding before the eyes of the world, and it is helping the Palestinians win what I call the second war, the legitimacy war, that may in the end turn out to be decisive. It is the way the United States lost the war in Vietnam and the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. In other words, the militarily superior side can dominate the battlefield and still lose the war. And I think this is happening in relation to Gaza and in relation to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And it's time that both Israel and the United States began to appreciate the limitations of military force and the fallacy of foreign counterinsurgency warfare as the way of pursuing their political objectives. It doesn't work. It causes incredible devastation and suffering, and it damages deeply the reputation and legitimacy of these two countries, their governments, to the extent they continue to rely on this kind of militarism to solve their foreign policy problems.
Richard Falk, UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, thank you very much for the work you do. I really encourage people to, you can start one at a time. I don't expect you to get through all of the 50 books. You can do it kind of seriatim, one right after the other. They're all worth reading. Richard Falk, thank you for spending some time with us and for the important work that you do.
Well, thank you, Mimi, for having me.
Mine eyes have seen the glory,
Allah,
of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching. Sonnet.
I have seen the watch fires of 100 circling camps.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
buildingbridgesradio.org.